This week's episode of War Rocket Ajax is brought to you by Loot Crate. Go to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax and use the coupon code War Rocket Ajax to get $3 off a brand new subscription.
Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That's War Rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we thank you for spending another 90-odd minutes with us in this episode. We're your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me as always is Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you tonight?
I'm great. The season is truly here because it's December, so we're playing the best song
here at the top the one. Of the show. the one that makes life worth living. the best use of the concept of music in the history of mankind.
I'm glad that we can finally fully embrace the season, Chris. I know you do this already, but we're going to have, you know, different words for the checks and wrecks now because it's December. You can smell the holly in the air.
Can you smell the holly? Is that a thing you do?
I was trying to think of like a spice associated with Christmas.
I think people would largely go with gingerbread, perhaps, Matt?
Gingerbread isn't exclusively a Christmas thing.
Matt, I wish you could see the look I am giving my microphone right now. What is it that we do on this show? For any new listeners who have dropped in, what is it that we do on this show, and what are we going to be doing today?
Apparently, we argue about Christmas smells. That's a thing we do.
I can't wait till this year's War Rocket Ajax Christmas Smells Spectacular.
That's right.
I couldn't even say it. I'm so upset.
Here's what we do. A lot of times, we will talk to a guest in the world of comics, but sometimes we don't do that. Sometimes we do special episodes where we rank comic book characters, and that's what we're doing this week. That's right, everybody. It's another Panel President special coming at you for our first December episode of the year, and that's going to be a lot of fun. But before we get to that, Chris, as usual, we have some business to take care of. The first item of which is thanking our newest supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. These are the people who have gone to patreon.com/warrocketajax, and they have kicked in as little as a dollar every month to help us keep the lights on and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills.
Here are our newest Patreon supporters. Fast Break Breakfast.
Okay, thank you, Fast Break Breakfast. That's the first and most important thing. Second, what is Fast Break Breakfast?
It's a podcast, I believe.
Oh, okay.
I believe,
is
I believe
it a podcast it's a, about breakfast? Because I'm very interested.
I think it is a basketball podcast, but it is a podcast hosted by one of our friends from the band How I Became the Bomb.
Cool.
I recently corresponded with. Next up, we have Rich Radka.
Oh, thank you, Rich.
Steven Darrell.
Thank you, Steven.
Possibly Darrell. Stephen Conway.
Thank you, other Stephen. Or, you know, I don't want to call you other Stephen. That's a little rude to you. You didn't know there was going to be another Stephen. So we'll just say, thank you, Stephen. Maybe you should go by Steve.
Additional Stephen.
I bet that guy hates going by Steve.
And
I am not doing so good on the thank yous this time. I'm really trying.
And Bradley Meek.
Oh, thank you, Bradley.
The Meek shall inherit ad-free episodes of War Rocket Ajax, which Patreon supporters get. At higher Patreon support levels, you get bonus audio, where we might argue about Christmas smells, cool stuff, swag, t-shirts, All kinds of cool
keychains.
Cool business from us here at War Rocket Ajax. Patreon supporters also get backer exclusive art, which we're working on our newest quarterly piece now. I think
we're gonna have a brand new piece. I've confirmed it with her, Shannon Maynor, who is, if you listen to Sailor Business, another podcast that I do, you've heard her a couple times. She's amazing. She's one of the artists who works on Archer, and she's gonna be doing our next art piece, which should be fantastic.
That's very exciting. That's coming really soon, maybe by the end of the year. If you would like to help us out, you can head over to Patreon and, as Chris said, kick in as little as $1. If you can't contribute anything, that's okay. You're going to continue to keep getting the show on iTunes as is, as has been happening for the past year. But if you can help us out, you get cool stuff, and you're doing us a big favor.
Before we move on, I actually have two other pieces of War Rocket Ajax business that I want to get out of the way, if you don't mind.
All right, let's get all this business done.
The first is that it is December, which means it's almost Christmas, which means it's almost New Year's, which means it's almost time for the Flash Gordon Memorial Awards.
That is true.
For those of you who may be new listeners, we do an award show every January, and the thing that sets our award show apart is that we pick the winners, but you submit the categories. You don't have to do it right now, but we're going to be coming up on the time when we will need to get the Gordy categories in. So if you have suggestions on what we should give out awards for this year, just shoot those in an email to warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. We will get to categorizing the Gordies for when we come back strong in 2017.
And this year, I'm going to ask that folks limit their number of categories to maybe a maximum of 4 or 5. So we don't have a huge list of categories that I have to cherry pick from. I'd rather just go from a list of a few categories that you think are your best categories for the Gordy Awards for 2017. So 4 or 5 categories at most. Submit those, as Chris said, to warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. What else we got, Chris?
Historically speaking, we usually pick a new fun game to play on the show here every year. We've obviously had a lot of success with the Every Story Ever list, which is still ongoing with monthly Patreon-supported Every Story Ever specials. We're doing a panel president special, which is where we rank characters. That's what's going on today, and that was our game for 2016. With 2017 on the horizon, I don't think we've decided if we're going to stick with Panel President and Every Story Ever, or if we're going to pick something new to do, but that is definitely something that you can let us know what you'd like to see, if you have a suggestion, if you have an idea, if you've got like if you're tired of Panel President. You can always just tweet at me and Matt. You can email us at the show and suggest things. We've got a couple possibilities, including just sticking with Panel President if people like it, which they seem to, but let us know. That's all of my December 1st, the day we are recording this, business that I need to get out of the way before the end of the year.
Piggybacking on that, my working plan for the moment is to continue Panel President. I did a poll a while back, I mentioned it a few episodes ago, where people said straight up, don't you dare stop doing Every Story Ever specials, so we will continue doing those. As for the regular post-interview segment on the show, people seem to like Panel President. If you would prefer us to do something else, then we can do something else. Maybe I'll do another poll where I'll just make it two choices. The after interview segment is either Panel President or something else. And then we can figure out what that something else is at a later date. That's probably what I'll do. I'll put up a poll the day this episode goes up. So on Twitter, find me, the Matt D. Wilson, and you can vote in that poll, and we'll see how that turns out. How's that sound, Chris?
That sounds perfect, Matt, because we want everybody to have a good time.
That's right. We're truly a democracy here on War Rocket Ajax. So
we're more of a Chris and Mattocracy, to be honest. But we do listen.
A comfort and joyocracy? Because I think that's what we're calling this segment. Comforts and joys.
Oh, that's right.
Chris, what's bringing you comfort this week?
We kind of talked to each other and decided that in lieu of our regular checks and recs slash comforts and joys that we're going to be doing this week, I think we're just going to focus on the recommendations aspect of it. Because, you know, we popped in. I don't know. I haven't been up to much since our last episode. Have you?
Aside from running lights at an improv show that was Christmas themed, which was very fun, and that Marlene performed in, not much, no.
Well, all I've been doing is, some weeks I have to struggle for things to recommend to our listeners. This week I've got four things to recommend.
Wow.
And I would have more, and we'll talk about that more next week. First, I want to talk about something that I think everybody, if you wanted it, you've got it. If you want it and you don't have it, you are a child. And you're waiting for Christmas, and you should not be listening to a show with an explicit tag on iTunes. Go tell your parents you're listening to War Rocket Ajax. It's Pokemon Moon. Aiden and I got Pokemon Sun and Moon. We really had an argument over who was going to get Moon. And I was eventually just like, yeah, it's got a bat. The legendary is literally a giant bat that looks like the bat signal. So that's the one I'm playing. Which one do you want?
She also wanted Moon.
She also wanted Moon, but she finally acquiesced, and she took the hit. She got Sun, so we have both of them in the household, so that we can trade with each other, which sure. Means that we never have to speak to other people, which is awesome.
Great, 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 great.
I think my all-time favorite Pokemon game is still Black. I just love the structure of Black and the way that it was 151 new Pokemon, and you didn't get the old ones until after you had completed the game. Sun and Moon do a lot of interesting and strange things. The Pokemon games, generally speaking, are very formulaic. You know, you go fight the eight gyms, you go to the Elite Four, you do all that stuff, and in between there's a plot. But this game is really different in a way that I like for the most part. There's no gyms, there's no gym leaders. You have trials that you go on, which can be different tasks. One of them was just, like, battle a bunch of Pokemon. One of them was go find a thing, like, do, like, a little fetch quest. One of them that I just did was literally an audio quiz that asked you what different sounds you hear playing the game are, which was interesting. One of the other things that it does is that instead of having the usual, like, moves like fly and surf and cut that you would use to access new parts of the map, instead, they have dedicated Pokemon that do those things that aren't in your party, but you can just call them, and instead of flying, you just ride around on a Charizard, which is awesome. The other thing it does is that it has the darkest Pokedex ever. I was really excited when this game was announced because there's a Pokemon called Rotom. Rotom is like a little electrical sprite, and depending on what it inhabits, it affects its type. So you can, like, put it into a microwave, and then you're carrying around basically a possessed microwave, or a washing machine, and it's water type, or like a lawnmower, and it's grass type. Your Pokedex is a Rotom, so your Pokedex is like a weird little sentient creature in this game. And everything it tells you about the Pokemon is horrifying. Like, I think Zubat's description is that it drinks blood, and sometimes it drinks too much and falls to the ground and becomes prey for other Zubat. There was one about how a big bear Pokemon will, like, loves to give hugs, but many trainers have died from being hugged too hard. The description of Gengar, one of my faves, is that it used to be human and now wants to kill people so that it has a traveling companion who's also a ghost. It's real, real dark, but I'm having a lot of fun with that game. So that's rec number one, Pokemon Moon. Rec number two, Matt, is something that I think you and I can both speak to, because I think we both bought it on the recent PlayStation Network sale, which is Just Cause 3.
Yeah, that one was going to be one of my recs too, so I guess we could share that one. It's real fun.
Yeah, now did you play Just Cause 2? Because I know I recommended it on the show, gosh, like 3 years ago whenever it came out, or whenever I played it.
I played Just Cause 2 because of you, because you gave me the game. As a wedding gift.
Oh, that's right. What a weird wedding gift. You know what? You didn't need a blender. You needed Just Cause 2. That's real.
That's right.
Just Cause, as a series, is about you In an island nation, so that you always have, like, an edge of the map that is water. You are destabilizing a corrupt government so that you can aid rebels in taking over. Which sounds like a very serious and depressing kind of game. You know, Ben Gully, our mutual friend, came over and hung out, and I referred to it as a regime change simulator. But the actual content of the game is always... It's over the top, almost to like a Naked Gun extreme.
The lead character, Rico Rodriguez, and the twist of Just Cause 3 is that he is returning to his home country.
Yes.
The country where he grew up.
Which is weird, because it's fake Italy. It's a country called Medici.
It's sort of like Italy plus Spain. Like different Mediterranean countries added together. And he single-handedly causes the regime change. I mean, he does. It's not single-handed. He has some people who help him. But he goes out in the field and creates enough chaos for the government to be overthrown, for dictators to be overthrown. That's the idea. And he is very cocksure about it. And he travels around by using a grappling hook and a parachute. Just Cause 3 adds in like a gliding suit where you can fall from a high perch and sort of glide along the ground because you have these two little flaps under your arms.
Yeah, like what Spider-Man used to have.
Like what Spider-Man. Like what I've seen, like which Batman movie is it where he puts the cape up and then it kind of becomes rigid and he can glide?
Batman Begins is when he does that.
There's an earlier one. It's either like Batman Returns or Batman Forever.
I mean, it's a common thing. Like he does it in all the Arkham games too.
Yeah. So it's that. He can do that. So,
but way more.
Yeah. Like there are challenges in Just Cause 3 that at first I absolutely hated and now are becoming my favorite part of the game, where you glide through using that suit, that equipment, you glide through these different rings and you have to try to get to the end of a course, and the closer to the center of the rings you get, the more points you get. And at first they are so frustrating to try to do, but then as you keep getting better and better at it, they become pretty fun.
The silliness of the game is what really makes it. Like, it's so over the top that I would say almost completely divorced from any kind of real life political thing. It's literally just the blowing stuff up parts of Saints Row.
Yeah, like your whole goal is to go around to these different bases and towns and blow up government property, military property, which is bright red, so you can tell what it is.
Yeah, they should stop painting that stuff bright red.
Until it's all gone. And then your rebels come in and take over that base or that town.
On top of being fun, because the entire appeal of the game is that there's a bunch of different ways to blow stuff up and, like, tear down statues of the evil dictator. So, you know, you can shoot it with a rocket launcher, you can grappling hook, attach it to a helicopter and just pull it right out of the ground. You can do all kinds of super weird stuff. But on top of all that, on top of, like, the fun gameplay, and I really do love wingsuiting around in that game, I think I currently have the longest wingsuit time record among my friends, because the game, for some reason, keeps track. But it is a very, very beautiful game. So much work was done into, kind of crafting the environment, because you get all these different sort of little biomes, I guess, and... The game is huge. Like, you start off and you're like, okay, this is the first island. Up there, that's the bigger island. And then you keep going and there's a much, much bigger island with a very, very high mountain on it. And it's just, it's a really pretty game. It's really beautiful and fun to just fly around in if you just want to kind of do that. And that's something I really appreciate too. So Just Cause is, it's a great put on a podcast and just goof around game, in addition to having kind of ridiculous story missions where every story mission feels like it could be the last one in the game.
Yes. And also, you know, I put on a podcast and goof around is a good way to put it, because I can't think of a series of games where the story matters less than in Just Cause.
Yeah, like even Saints Row doesn't approach it.
Yeah, all you have to know is there's a dictator and you're trying to get him out of this country. Go at it.
So that's rec number two, Just Cause 3. Rec number three is an album that I think everyone should have in their rotation this year. It is maybe the only, like, it's in the pantheon with A Christmas Gift to You and the Jackson 5 Christmas. It's a holiday soul party by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. Matt, do you have this one?
Oh, you bet. You bet.
Yeah. It's on Amazon Prime streaming, and it's on Spotify. So if you have either of those, you can just play it right now. Well, after War Rocket Ajax. And it's just a fantastic, fantastic holiday album. Sharon Jones very, very sadly passed away just a few weeks ago. And we are much poorer for her loss. This album is one of my, I think, all-time favorites. If you listen to Hark, which is an amazing podcast where they rank holiday music all year round, a couple of these songs, like 8 Days of Hanukkah, and I think maybe Ain't No Chimneys in the Projects has been on there too. You might have heard those, and they're great. 8 Days of Hanukkah is, I say this as a person who is not of the Jewish faith, but I would say I have never heard a Hanukkah song better than the one on the Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings album, and it's track one. They front-loaded it.
It's real good. It's real, yeah. Real good.
Absolutely, go grab that album. You can pick it up for $7 on Amazon if you prefer to buy rather than stream. But you should absolutely get it. That's rec number three. Rec number four, and this is going to be real quick, is actually a comic Kickstarter that's happening now. This is the last week of it as you're listening to this. It's called Paradox Girl. It was sent to me by the creators, and look, I will be honest, I get a lot of press releases. I get a lot of people emailing me and being like, oh, hey, check out my comic. And I do my best to keep up with them, and it is not a judgment on the quality if I don't talk about them. But I would be remiss if I did not talk about this, because it is absolutely one of the most clever comics I have ever read in my life. It is a story by Katie Borquin and Yishan Lee. Yishan Lee is currently drawing, I believe, the Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the high school years comic. And the premise is that the main character, Paradox Girl, can teleport through time and space. So there's always five or six of her around at any given time at different points in her life. And the way that is used and the way she moves between through time and space and also through the panels of the comic, it's a thing where I saw it and I just stopped reading. Because I was like, how do you do this? This is, like, I don't even know how you would describe this to an artist, let alone, like, make it all come together as well as it does. The Kickstarter is for the second set of three issues, 4, 5, and 6. They do stand on their own, and I am going to be interviewing the creators this week on Comics Alliance if you want to find out more. But legitimately, number one, which you can also get from this Kickstarter if you pledge, I think you can get it digitally if you pledge $9, which is amazing. You get 1 through 6 digitally for $9. Number one has one of the best sequences I've ever read in my life of reading comics. So definitely check that out. Paradox Girl, it's on Kickstarter, and you should get it. That was Rec 4, done with Recs.
Yeah, and I'm not really going to add anything to that much. I'm going to stick with my rec for Just Cause 3. I may rec the Batman Telltale game when I get around to playing it, but I haven't yet. And I also picked up Doom in the PS Store sale. So you might be hearing about that from me in the near future. But for now, I'll just co-rec Just Cause 3, and Chris, we can get right into talking about some comics. Let's start with talking about the New Talent Showcase, number one, that came out from DC this week. An interesting anthology book that I think at first seemed like it was going to be a showcase not only for the people in the writer's talent program, but for people in the artist talent program. But apparently not so much people in the artist talent program, because all the artists in this are, or most of the artists in this, are established comics artists. And then if you look on the back page, it specifically says this is from the writer's talent program. So this is all stories by people in that writer's program. Chris, what did you think?
It's a weird book. Like you said, there's a, you know, you go into a book called New Talent Showcase kind of expecting everybody to be new, you know, to be someone that you haven't really heard of that much. And on the art side, what threw me off is that there's artists like Cary Randolph, like Emmanuel Lupacino, like Sonny Liu, who did a series for Vertigo like 10 years ago and just did Dr. Fate last year. Barnaby Bagenda, who drew Omega Men, like one of the most critically acclaimed comics in recent memory from DC. But then you get into the writers, which are the people who have gone through the DC's talent development program. And even then, it's very strange to be someone who reads comics as much as we do and seeing, you know, New Talent Showcase with, like, Christopher Sabella or Michael Morici or Joelle Jones, which are creators, you know, that I like. You know, Sabella is a friend of the show, and he's someone whose work I really, really love. But I feel like he's been around for a while. But that's, like, the interesting thing in general about DC's talent development program. It's a weird thing, you know? It's always a little weird. And I do appreciate it. You know, circa 2000 to maybe, like, 2010, like, there was always this idea that I had that, you know, nobody can really break in at DC. Like, every now and then you'll see somebody breaking in through Vertigo, like Jason Aaron. But you don't see them breaking in on a core DC Universe title. Nothing with Batman in it, you know? And now it looks like that's changing. So I really wanted to check out the New Talent Showcase. And there's a lot of really interesting stories in here. But structurally, it's still a really weird book because almost all of the stories are cliffhangers. And I legitimately have no idea if they are going to continue. Like, I don't know if this is DC launching a new anthology that's just going to feature all of these creators, and we're just going to get these stories continuing every month for 6 months or whatever. Or if they're going to launch a bunch of new titles and we're going to see like a Kyle Rayner book.
What's strange is that some of the stories end pretty definitively. Like the Harley Quinn story that Joelle Jones wrote just ends. The little tag at the end is TTFN, mm-hmm. which is not a cliffhanger per se. Like Harley just goes running out of, you know, Arkham Asylum, and that's the end of it. And then some others end on absolute cliffhangers with the promise of more.
Yeah, like the it opens with a Hellblazer story, which I actually like really enjoyed, but there's a twist in that Hellblazer story where you find out that John Zatara has done something that not only like got him sent to hell, but that he did something that also damned Zatanna. And that's from Adam Smith and Saya Oum. It's called The Road to Hell. And it's like a really, you know, interesting Hellblazer story. And it ends on this note where you see, you know, John Constantine has learned that something, you know, that hell has a claim on Zatanna's soul, and that's the end of the story, you know? Which, I would love to see more of that, and I would love to see, honestly, a lot of the stuff that's in here. But it's weird not knowing, you know?
All these stories feel like what you would really think you would be getting from a New Talent Showcase, which is all of these people coming in fresh and saying, like, I have this take on X character.
Yes.
And I would love to write it. Like, Chris Sabella clearly has a take on Deadman. And this is his take on Deadman. And the take on Hawkwoman in this, or Hawkgirl, by Erica Schultz, really goes in a strange direction.
But it's one that I like. It's one that I would absolutely enjoy seeing more of.
Oh yeah, I mean it's different for sure. I thought that one was maybe the weirdest of the stories in the book, but it's pretty cool. And then Michael Marici has a Kyle Rayner romance story in this. It's like a sci-fi romance story that's really clever. Like everything is coming from this, like, I have an angle.
Yeah.
Like, just let me do my angle.
It very much feels like part of the class, the 13-week course that's Scott Snyder and I think, you know, Klaus Janson and Jim Lee are also involved because Janson does the cover. It feels like it's like, okay, if you could pitch a DC Universe character, what would your first, what would your first issue be? Like, how would you set up? You're writing Deadman number one. You're writing Harley Quinn number one. You're writing Hawkgirl number one. Like, what would you do in your first issue? Now compress that down to 10 pages.
Yeah.
So it's all interesting. And honestly, it's really fun, like, I think for us, especially as writers, to kind of see, like, okay, here's what Sabella would do with Deadman. And here's, like, how he would condense that pitch down to 10 pages. But it's also, like, it's a weird book to read and a very interesting one, I think.
But some of these stories are, if you were writing X book, what would you do with them? And then some of them are like, if you had a just like whatever team up book where you could throw some characters together, what would you do with that? Because there's a Catwoman Wonder Woman story in here.
That Catwoman Wonder Woman story is like, I would love to see more of that. Like it's a really, really, really fun setup. It's like an episode of Leverage. It's called the Amazonian Job.
Yeah, I mean it starts out as a heist story. Like the Catwoman and Wonder Woman come together under weird circumstances. Under circumstances that superheroes don't normally team up with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then there's some other, like there's a Flash Wonder Woman team up in here as well. There's a little bit of just like throwing characters together that's really interesting too, that you don't normally see from like certainly like the first issue of a solo title that I think is pretty cool.
A lot of really interesting stuff in here. I will be really interested to see if we get the launch of new stories out of this, which I honestly hope we do, because everything in here is at least worth reading. And there's some stuff where I'm like, that's a great pitch. Like, there's some stuff where I'm like, that's genuinely, I would love to see more of this. Or if this is just going to be like a weird little artifact of the talent development program. There's one more weird thing about it. The solicitation, as it originally ran, said that Marici and Beginda's story, Michael Marici and Barney Beginda, was going to be a team up between Kyle Rayner and Carol Danvers, which is very unlikely.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
In the description that runs, obviously someone noticed and fixed it in the solicitation that's currently on Comixology, and they got it wrong. They had to guess, and they got it wrong. It says Kara Danvers now, you know, Supergirl. It's supposed to be Carol Ferris.
Yeah, it's Carol Ferris.
Yeah. So somebody... Some poor assistant editor was just a little distracted that day.
Let's move on to talking quickly about Batman Annual Number 1, which came out this week.
Matt, you have not read this one, I think you
said. I have not. I popped it open in Comixology, but I haven't actually read through it.
Okay.
We've got a Tom King, David Finch story leading things off.
Yeah, here's the thing. This is actually Batman Christmas Special 2016. Every story is a Christmas story. They just called it Batman Annual for some reason. So I'm down 100%. But that lead story, the Tom King, David Finch story, is A, a Christmas story, B, a Christmas story about Alfred giving Bruce a gift, and C, the new origin of Rebirth era Ace the Bat-Hound. It's the fucking content I am here for.
Yeah, that's
literally all I have to say about it. It's been fucking fantastic. I loved it.
Ace the Bat-Hound is all through this. Alfred gets him at the pound. It's great.
Yeah. And also, you get the origin for why he's called Ace.
Yep. Yep. I'm paging through it now, and there it is.
I love it. I love
this is This is very good. This is a very good comic book story.
Yes. Bless you, Tom King. This is my favorite David Finch story of all time. But bless you, Tom King and David Finch, for giving us light in these terrible times.
Also, we have a Scott Snyder, Ray Fox Christmas story. Then a Paul Dini Christmas story.
Oh, yeah. A Paul Dini, Neil Adams story. And
Neil Adams art in this, yeah.
And it's a sequel to another Neil Adams Christmas story from the 70s.
But Harley Quinn is in it.
It's a sequel to The Silent Night of the Batman.
Yeah.
This is the not-so-silent night of the Harley Quinn. It's delightful. Like, everything in this issue I thought was fun and solid. But that lead story with Ace, the story of the year. Now, Matt, you also wanted to talk about Black Widow number 9.
Basically, I can just stick with, hey, if you were wondering if this series stayed good from issue 1, it did. Mark Waid and Chris Samnee are still doing a great job with it. I really like the way that the story has gone since getting going, because it started with this big mystery of who was manipulating Black Widow. And now that mystery has been more or less solved, and it has turned into a story where Black Widow is trying to prevent what drove her into the life that she has now of being, you know, a spy assassin, more or less, and prevent that from happening to other girls. This particular issue is much like other issues of this series, kind of one big action sequence or one sort of one scene in an action movie, right? And it's all about Black Widow posing as a White House tour guide to save the vice president from being assassinated by elementary school age girls. And it is great because it starts with this whole thing where Black Widow is trying to figure out which of these girls is the assassin. Then there's a little twist, and then there's, you know, all this stuff happening where she's trying to stop the assassination attempt. You know, Mark Waid is a great writer. We've talked about him at length. Chris Samnee does so much heavy lifting on this Black Widow book, though. Chris Samnee should be winning art awards just because there is so much story being told in the art in this book specifically. I mean, I guess some of it is a testament to, you know, Mark Waid having been in comics for as long as he has, sort of as the writer stepping back and letting the art tell the story. But you have to have somebody like a Chris Samnee for that to work. And boy, does Chris Samnee make it work. If you haven't been checking out Black Widow, you know, this would even be a fun issue to start with. It gives plenty of the backstory as you're going through it. And you can pick it up pretty quick. So, yeah, it's real good. All right, Chris, that's going to do it for our comic segment. We're going to get into ranking some characters here in just a minute. But before we do that, we've got a little bit of information to give to our listeners about Loot Crate. Loot Crate. It's a box. It comes to your house once a month. It's got cool, exclusive items, 6 to 8 of them. You pay less than $20 a month for those items. You don't even have to go anywhere, right? You just sign up for the thing. They send this stuff to your house. And then you get this box full of cool stuff. I don't know about you guys. I don't know about you, Chris. But the promise of you don't have to go anywhere, that's huge for me.
Okay, listen. A, not going anywhere is literally the best thing in the world.
It really is.
B, you especially don't want to go anywhere when you are buying things in December. And here's the thing you might not have realized about Loot Crate. Loot Crate, you can give that stuff to other people. You could get a Loot Crate subscription for a friend for Christmas and give them the gift of 6 to 8 exclusive items every month, including t-shirts, including stuff that you cannot find anywhere else. People always tell me I'm extremely hard to shop for because my interests have been the same for 20 years and I buy myself things. The thing about Loot Crate is it's new stuff every time. It's stuff you might not know about. Like when they did a small version of John Morris's book, The League of Regrettable Superheroes, which makes a fantastic gift. If you had gotten the Loot Crate version of that and you didn't know about that book already, all of a sudden you've got the perfect gift for the people who like weird superheroes in your life.
Yeah, I mean, look, a lot of the stuff in the loot crate you're going to want to keep, right?
I mean, like, that's true. You got a couple options.
But if there's somebody that you know who you know is a huge fan of, say, let's say, Assassin's Creed, right?
Okay, that's something we like.
Or let's say Mr. Robot, the USA show Mr. Robot.
Haven't seen it, heard it's good.
Or let's say, a show that people like, maybe called Firefly.
Okay, that's right? One that people do like.
Or say, you know, somebody who collects Funko Pops. Or like somebody who's just like, they love t-shirts. Or pins to put on their backpack or their jacket.
I love pins.
That's all stuff.
I legit love pins.
Yeah, Marlene loves pins. She just bought a new They Live pin that she has on her coat right now. Like, that's all stuff that you're going to get in this month's Loot Crate, in the December Loot Crate, which is themed around Revolution, so you can see how that all comes together. Assassin's Creed, Mr. Robot, Firefly. You have until December 19th at 9 p.m. to subscribe to the December Loot Crate and get it. But if you want to get it and have gifts for people, you're going to get the Loot Crate throughout the year. You could hold back something that comes in your Loot Crate in May and save it for a friend who you know loves a particular thing. Give it to them for their birthday, give it to them for Christmas, whatever. So you might want to do this before December 19th, but the absolute cutoff is December 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific time. After that time, this Loot Crate that I'm talking about, the Revolution Loot Crate, not going to be available anymore. And you're not going to have gifts for yourself or gifts for your friends. You're going to have to wait until the following month, until January. And then maybe, like I said, you could hold back gifts all year long. Either way, whatever your plan is, you can head over to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax. Use the code WarRocketAjax and get $3 off your brand new subscription. Now, here's what you're going to do by doing that. You're going to give yourself the gift of a deal. And you're going to give us at WarRocketAjax the gift of your support.
The important thing here is $3 off a new subscription at lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax using the coupon code WarRocketAjax. But I do want to point out that if anybody out there was asked to bet on which host was going to recommend that you keep everything for yourself and which host was going to recommend that you give it as a gift, you just lost a lot of money. Get that $3 back at lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax, a coupon code WarRocketAjax.
Let's rank some characters. This is our ongoing segment for 2016, possibly for 2017, where we take your listener-submitted lists of comic book characters and we assemble them into our giant master list. We elect the best. We impeach the worst. Panel president.
Currently have 139 characters on here. Top of the list has been there for a while. Spider-Man, Peter Parker. Bottom of the list also has been there for a while. Hemo-Goblin. A lot of variety mixed in here.
One thing we are kind of missing on the panel president list is sort of an even matchup of male characters and female characters.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten a few lists that attempt to add a lot more female representation. Here's one of them from Line Stepper DS Randlett. First one on this list. This one's gonna be tough, Chris.
Okay. I should say before you say it, our highest ranking female character currently is the unbeatable Squirrel Girl Doreen Green at number 12.
I feel like this one might crack the top 10.
Oh, okay.
It's Lois Lane.
Lois real good.
Lois is increasingly one of my favorites. I never disliked Lois. Now she is one of my top tier favorite characters ever.
What has changed for you? Like, what are you reading that made that distinction?
You know, it's not even necessarily what I'm reading. It's my life changed. Like, I became a news reporter. You know, I realized I can't be Superman, right? I mean, look, every man can be a Superman.
Yeah, dude can reach each other and every man can be a Superman.
Right. But, like, Superman is an aspirational character, but he's that kind of aspirational character that you can never achieve. Lois Lane is an aspirational character of just somebody who works really hard, does her job really well, and tries to do the right thing in her job day to day, which is not something I could relate to as a kid. It's something I could relate to as an adult 100%.
I once had a really good conversation with Dean Tripp about Lois, and he really put Lois into a, not necessarily a new light, but what he said really made it click for me, which is that Lois Lane does what Superman does without powers. She is constantly looking for truth and justice. Like, she has devoted her life to the pursuit of truth, and that she does that better than anyone else in the world, including Superman himself, is the reason he loves her. Again, I'm like you. Like, I never disliked Lois. I love Lois. And I will admit, I love Lois's goofy Silver Age adventures more than anything else about Lois. But, like, that made her, like, that made me realize why she works so well as a character. And why, like, you can never really get away from Lois as a reporter. Like, that's something that, you know, I don't think can ever change. It is necessary for her character.
Yeah, and you know, there are a lot of different versions of Lois. Like, the Silver Age version of Lois that you brought up has a lot of flaws. Namely, in that Superman thinks she always needs to be taught a lesson.
Yes.
Of some kind. But in her best incarnations, Lois, her flaws are examples of how she is noble and good. Cause like, she has this flaw of, like, looking down on Clark Kent or being hyper competitive, right? But she's hyper competitive because she knows, or she wants to be able to have the story so that she can do the best job with it.
Yeah.
And so that she can do the most good with it. It's not a matter of wanting fame and attention, even though I guess there are versions of Lois who do want those things from her reporting. But the best version of Lois wants to get the story because she wants to be the one that brings down Lex. She wants to be the one that exposes the, you know, Intergang or whoever. She's hungry to do those good things. And I admire that kind of stuff about those versions of Lois immensely. I think Lois probably goes in our top 10. I think I would put her above J. Jonah Jameson.
That's, I mean, coming from you, that's surprising. But look, I mean, look, oh, I agree with you.
It's not Lois even a question great for me. J. Jonah, despite having those moments of depth, is sort of one note in a way that Lois is not. I don't know. I would even consider putting her above the Joker. There's a part of me that thinks she goes between Joker and Jonah. And there's a part of me that thinks she goes above Captain America.
I mean, she's really good. It's
and foundational. More foundational than any other character on this list except Superman.
Here's the thing. I think she's – I would give – in terms of being foundational, I would give Ben Grimm the edge on that. I don't think she goes above Ben, but Ben's, like, really fucking good.
Okay, in that case, then, I think she goes between Ben and the Joker. Because the more we talk about Lois, the higher I want to put her.
I mean, look, she's real good.
So I think that's where Lois Lane goes, between the Thing and Joker.
I think that is where we have to put her. At number All right, seven next up, on the list, Lois Lane.
Next up on the list is Wonder Woman, Diana Prince.
Before I say this, I want to remind everyone that Matt reads the emails. The emails go to Matt. But this is something I've written about before. I like the idea of Wonder Woman. I like Wonder Woman under certain circumstances. I like Wonder Woman stories. And I've never been, like, a huge fan of Wonder Woman as a character herself. And I say that recognizing her importance, her legacy, her I absolutely think she should be, like, the third part of the Trinity, you know, at DC Comics. But for some reason, outside of like maybe three or four creators, I've never gotten that Wonder Woman story that I really, really love that's made me love the character in the way that like that I've had like conversations with Greg Rucka and I know he loves the character. I've never had that in the way that I've had with others.
The problem that everybody says writers have with Superman, I think, is the problem that writers really have with Wonder Woman.
I think you might be right. I think there's a lot of desire to fix Wonder Woman. And I think I'm, you know, I am as guilty of that as everyone else. I think, you know, a lot of people who recognize a character's importance but don't necessarily like them themselves, you know, will often find themselves going, okay, well, how would I fix her? And I think I think in a lot of ways that can be a losing game.
But even if you draw back from like in the trenches of like story considerations, mm-hmm. and you just think about cultural considerations, Superman is obviously an aspirational character who is important to a lot of readers. But there are plenty of other superheroes who can fill in gaps when a Superman story isn't particularly good or during a period when the Superman books aren't particularly good. With Wonder Woman, I can imagine somebody feeling a particular weight on their shoulders of this is the superheroine. Like, there are other female superheroes, lots of them, but none of them are as visible or have the history of Wonder Woman. And so I think you approach Wonder Woman saying, okay, this, I've got to write this role model for little girls, but I've also got to make the stories interesting, and I've got to check off all these boxes, right? And that can be harrowing and daunting in a way that I think maybe no other character in comics presents. If you're writing Supergirl, you know, one thing about so many female superheroes is that they're analogs of male superheroes, they're offshoots of male superheroes, or they're newer, like even Batwoman is one of them, but like a newer character like Batwoman, who is very high ranking on our list, like she hasn't been around as long, there's not the weight of history. I guess there's the history of like Kathy Kane leading up to Kate Kane, but she's a different character. Wonder Woman is her own thing. She's been around nearly as long as Superman. And, you know, I think that she is the one, like, if a little girl is trying to get into comics for the first time, or her mom's like, I want to buy you a comic with a lady doing cool superhero stuff, they're going to look for a Wonder Woman comic.
Yeah. Wonder Woman has a cultural presence that is literally matched only by Superman and Batman. In the way that there have been – one of my major criticisms of Wonder Woman that I don't necessarily know if I stand by still today, but it's certainly one that I've felt in the past, was that if you ask me, hey, what's the Batman story to read? I can give it to you. I'll give you your one. And I'll be like, this is it. This is the one. You know, or even, you know, I might give you Zero Year, or I can point to – this is the one. If you ask me that for Superman, I can do that. I can give you like the Superman story. And I feel like we have had Wonder Woman for 76, 77 years coming up. And I don't know that there's the Wonder Woman story. And I don't think that's a failing of the character, but I think that does come from her being a weirdly constructed character. You know, she has an American flag costume because she's created in World War II, but she's not American. She has a TV show that everybody has fond memories of, but the TV show itself is weird. There's like a season of it happens in World War II and a season of it happens in the 70s. She's not there right after Crisis. She comes later. There have been so many different takes on her, and there's so much stuff that like tries to blend superheroics with mythology. And, you know, the Robert Kaniger stuff is so weird. She becomes a very daunting character for me as a reader. And on top of all that is the idea that, you know, she's a character that kids love instantly because they see her and she is the superheroine. She, in the way that every superhero descends from Superman in one way or another, every superheroine descends from Wonder Woman. But there's not, like, what do you give a kid? What do you give an 8-year-old who wants to read Wonder Woman comics?
I mean, I think that what people would say is the Wonder Woman story is probably the Perez run, but I don't think that's the one you give a kid either, so I don't know.
But I don't think the Perez run, I mean, this isn't every story ever, but I don't think the Perez run holds up as well as Man of Steel or Year One. Like, because it is, it's weird. It's weird.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, some of that's baked in because of all the mythology stuff and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, so I think what we have to do is weigh the cultural icon that is Wonder Woman against the Wonder Woman who has appeared in comic books for going on 80 years. Where does that character land?
I don't think we are. I don't think we have ever made listeners as angry as we're going to inevitably make them with this ranking. not even with Hal Jordan. I think Batwoman is a more enjoyable character for me. I like Batwoman a lot more. I'm more likely to read a new Batwoman story than I am to read a new Wonder Woman story. All other things being equal, I would rather read a new Greg Rucka, Nicholas Scott Batwoman story than a Greg Rucka, Nicholas Scott Wonder Woman story. Just because I like that character better. But there's a larger context here. You know who I think she's comparable to? Wolverine.
That's actually where I was looking as well.
Yeah.
Because my floor was going to be Mary Jane Watson. She can't possibly go below Mary Jane. Do you think she would go above or below Wolverine?
I think she goes above. I think she goes between Barda and Wolverine.
Okay.
I would... There are very few characters. There are only 17 characters I would put above Barda currently. But I think Wonder Woman has so much great iconography, so much potential, so much, you know, a great storytelling stuff waiting to be tapped into, and maybe that has been tapped into it in the past. And I will more than acknowledge that of the major superheroes, I have the least experience reading Wonder Woman. She's not as good as Barda. Barda's great.
The next one is Black Canary.
Now, is this Dinah Laurel Lance? Or is this Dinah Lance?
The name that is given is Dinah Lance.
Okay. Problem with Black Canary. Black Canary was an Earth 2 character who came to Earth 1 in the 70s and then was retconned in the 80s to be two different characters, a mother and daughter, and then re-retconned into one character, and then re-retconned into one character who was a different character. Black Canary's a weird one.
Here's my prediction. I don't think we're going to get either of the separate mother-daughter Black Canary characters. Mm-hmm. So I think we can just put this all together in one Black Canary.
Okay. I love
Black Canary. That's what I'm going
to say. I really do. I think Black Canary's awesome. I think
she's a great idea for a character, and she is one of the earliest characters, I feel like, because she came around in the Silver Age, right?
Black Canary was a Golden Age character, dude.
She was actually around in the Golden Age.
Yeah.
I feel like she, of all those early superheroine characters, and Black Canary's another one who isn't, you know, a female version of a male character, which I think also gives her a lot of benefit. She didn't have the timidity of a lot of early female characters.
No, she wears a leather jacket and rides a motorcycle.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. You know, she is who she is from the get-go.
One of the things that's really interesting about Canary is that you often see her in the context of Green Arrow. But she doesn't necessarily fulfill the traditional love interest role. There are a couple stories that do. I mean, in my youth, I did enjoy Longbow Hunters, but it is certainly a story that, you know, I've kind of moved past as a reader. The trick with Black Canary and Green Arrow is that Black Canary doesn't need Green Arrow. Green Arrow is better with Black Canary. Black Canary's still good when she's solo. But Black Canary also works...
Or when she's on a team that Green Arrow isn't on.
Yeah, or when she's with Babs, with Oracle or Batgirl. Like, the dynamic between Batgirl and Black Canary is legit one of the best, like, female friendships at DC Comics. Like, it's one of the best friendships in general.
That Birds of Prey dynamic and putting her into the Birds of Prey was a great thing to do with Black Canary. Because it gets her out of the orbit of Green Arrow and lets her be, you know, the character that she is and lets her interact with some new characters that's one of the best times of Black Canary, is that period of Birds of, where she was in the Birds of Prey.
Yeah, yeah. I think Black Canary is awesome. Where do you think she goes? Do you think she's as good as Mary Jane?
Yeah. I mean, I think she's better than Oliver Queen.
I think she is, too. I think she's certainly better than... Do we have Green Arrow on the list?
I don't think we have Oliver Queen on the list right now.
No, but we don't have Oliver
Queen. She would go above him.
Yeah, she definitely would.
I think she's above Mary Jane. I don't know that she's above Commissioner Gordon.
Then I think that's a good place to put her. So entering the list at number 23.
Next one on DS's list is Nightcrawler, Kurt Wagner.
Writing an X-Men book, we get asked about Nightcrawler a lot.
You know why?
Why?
Because Nightcrawler's the best X-Man.
I don't know if that's the case. Do you know about Gambit? You heard about Gambit, my man? My dude?
I am familiar, yes.
Nightcrawler should almost not be an X-Man. Nightcrawler's such like a good Marvel character that, honest to God, being an X-Man kind of holds him back. Like, that dude should just be having adventures all the time.
It's telling that people's favorite Nightcrawler stuff is not necessarily when he's in a mainstream X-Men book, but is in kind of one of the side books like Excalibur.
Nightcrawler is a concept I love. And Nightcrawler is a design I love. He's got that great Dave Cockrum design. And he's one of the rejected Legionnaires. Or not rejected, but like I don't... One of those characters that he was originally created to be a Legionnaire before Cockrum got the X-Men job. Good design. You give that dude a sword and he's perfect. There's no better design than that Nightcrawler holding a sword.
Great powers. Just a cool look.
Yeah. And one of the best... If the X-Men are a metaphor, Nightcrawler is the least subtle part of the metaphor. Because he looks like a devil, but he's a good guy. So when we first see him, he's being chased by literal pitchfork and torch mob. But he's like the nicest dude.
And he's religious. He looks like a devil, but he's religious.
Yeah, Nightcrawler's great. It's weird that he's not part of my X-Men. Not the X-Men that I write, but like the X-Men that I always think of as the X-Men. Like, he's not in that group, even though I've read the entire Claremont Cockrum, Claremont Byrne run, and he's there for all of it. I just wish there was more Nightcrawler solo stuff, because he's such a good character. Such a beautiful design. So, you know, he's one of those perfect comic book characters. He has powers that are so good on the page. So do you really think he's the best X-Men?
It is over now. I don't know if he's the best, but I've when people have always asked me, like, who's your favorite, Nightcrawler is always my answer.
Would you,
of my favorite X-Men.
Would you put him above Wolverine?
I don't guess so. Just because Wolverine's such a versatile and important character.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a lot of love personally for Nightcrawler. I could put him above Kitty Pryde, though.
That might get us more hate mail than the Wonder Woman stuff. I think Kitty's better, but I think Nightcrawler's probably better than Marvel Dracula, who's right under Kitty Pryde.
Okay, then that's where he's going to go, between Kitty Pryde and Dracula.
But I wish Nightcrawler had a 70-issue solo series of him just having adventures. I think that would be great.
Yeah, or like just him like teaming up with different people every issue.
All right, so entering the list.
Because that's one of the great things about...
Okay.
That's one of the great things about Kurt, is that he's always friendly and gregarious with whoever he is paired with.
He's such a good team-up character. He plays off of other people so well.
Great team-up character.
Yeah, entering the list number 29, Kurt Wagner, Nightcrawler.
Finally on DS's list is Swamp Thing, which is named here as Alec Holland, but we...
Well, as we all know.
Yeah,
Swamp Thing fucking rules. Swamp Thing's great. Swamp Thing as a character is less interesting than Swamp Thing the plot device, though. Let's be real.
Sure.
Like, look, Swamp Thing's good. Swamp Thing's real, real good. But Swamp Thing the character is hard to relate to. Swamp Thing might be the best... I mean, I say this knowing Dracula's on the list. He might be the best, like, monster character ever. The human monster in the original, like, Wien and Wrights and stuff, to, like, the Moor and Beset and Tottlebin stuff, where he's, like, pure avatar of the Green Swamp thing. Like, that's good stuff.
I mean, I guess it depends on whether you consider Ben Grimm the Thing to be a monster.
No, I consider... No. No, he's not a monster. How dare you?
I mean, this man, this monster.
He's a man. Matt, did you read that story? He's a man.
Yes, I did.
How dare you? No, Swamp Thing is good, but I think Swamp Thing is, from a character standpoint, not as good. Like, certainly not as good as a Ben Grimm. You know, come on. But, like, such a good character to build stories around, you know?
Yes, but I feel like Swamp Thing is a lot like Frank Castle.
Mm-hmm.
In that Swamp Thing can't often be the driver of the story. Something has to be happening in the radius of Swamp Thing, and then Swamp Thing gets involved. Much like the Punisher is reactive, I think Swamp Thing has to be reactive. Outside of a handful of stories where Swamp Thing is the driving force, where you learn something foundational or origin related about Swamp Thing. You know, if you're going to do an ongoing series about Swamp Thing, Swamp Thing's got to just kind of react to something that's happening in the swamp.
Well,
you know what I mean?
In the green. Like,
or in the green, yeah. Which is a relatively new addition to Swamp Thing, I feel like.
Well, I mean, but, it goes back to the Alan Moore stuff in the 80s. You know, Swamp Thing, that's been there for most of Swamp Thing's tenure, I would say.
Like, it's a weird comparison, I guess, to the Punisher, but that's kind of how I feel about it.
No, I think you're onto something with that. But yeah, I would say maybe just below Marvel Dracula? No, because Captain Marvel is just below Marvel Dracula, and Billy Batson is way better than Swamp Thing. Just above Roast Beef? The characters that we have below that I would say are, like, arguably better than Swamp Thing. I mean, I do think he's very comparable to Plastic Man, who's very close below.
Here's where I would say put him. I would say put him between Deadpool and Kingpin.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, that feels right. That feels right. Let's put him there at number 40 on the list.
All right. Mike Sterling, don't be mad at us.
He doesn't listen to the show. Maybe he does. I think he does, actually.
he does. I know he does.
He tells us, he tweets at us often about it.
Yep, he sure does.
Mike can send in right, Sluggo, and we'll give him special consideration.
Here's another list from Josh Sinison or Sinison. I never know which one it is. This is a list of top shooting ladies and two other faves.
All right, okay? So we've got a lot of people who are correcting our list and its deficiencies right now.
Yes. First one on Josh's list is Rogue.
I loved Rogue when I was 10. I hated Rogue when I was 20. I really love Rogue at 34.
For those that don't know, that's Anna Marie,
mm-hmm.
The X-Man who can absorb people's abilities, but at their peril. Rogue, I think, is one of those characters who is just really cool when you're younger.
Mm-hmm.
Then you reach an age where you get the metaphor and you kind of get that feeling of like, oh, we get it.
Yeah.
Right.
It gets real tired when you're about 17.
Yeah. Where it's just like, yeah, I get the metaphor for, you know, whatever Rogue is a metaphor for at that time. Right. The I can't love you. I mean, it's
can't love you, Remy.
Like there's definitely STD stuff in there.
Well, there's that. There's, you know, like traumatic early sexual experiences. There's, you know, abstinence-only education. I think Rogue being a Bible Belt Southerner plays a lot into that from Caldecott County, Mississippi. But Rogue is brilliant. Rogue is like Ultra Boy brilliant because she has to exist in a comic book world to make any sense. Because she doesn't just, like, yeah, she can kiss you and put you in a coma and steal your memories and whatever. But Rogue's primary function is to steal mutant powers. To steal other people's superpowers.
She doesn't exist without other superpowered people. Also.
She doesn't exist without a Marvel universe around her that makes her work, which is fucking brilliant. And the evolution of Rogue to, is Rogue better when she has the Carol Danvers powers and she's, you know, Superman strong and she can fly? Is she better when it's just like absorbing other people's powers temporarily? Is it better when she can control that or not? You see that evolution with her and people trying out different things, and honest to God, it all works. Like, it really all works. Like, can she control her powers? Can she not control her powers? Either way, you can make her work in a really cool way. And in the way that I think Nightcrawler works well in team-ups, Rogue obviously doesn't work super well in a solo story because she can't absorb anybody's powers in a solo story if she's, you know, just fighting fucking Stiltman. Right. But Rogue is a perfect team character. She's a perfect team character. It's brilliant. I love Rogue.
Rogue is great also in that she brings a sensibility and personality to the X-Men team that other characters don't have. You know, Jean Grey, you talk about timid characters. Marvel Girl, in her first few appearances, definitely had that timidity that I was talking about Black Canary not having. Kitty Pryde has that taking it all in, reader identification thing going on in her early appearances. Storm is very regal and poised, right? And Rogue is just like, she's swaggery in a way that is great. Because even though she has that swagger, she also is incredibly vulnerable. But when she's just kind of out having fun and enjoying herself, she has a swagger like no other X-Men character.
Mm-hmm. One of the most fun characters to write, by far, because of that very reason.
Yeah.
Again.
Okay. What neighborhood of the list?
Again, I'm like looking at that Black Canary, Mary Jane, like right under Commissioner Gordon list. Like I don't think Rogue goes above Wonder Woman, who's at 19. But I think you could argue that she's. Like, I certainly feel like she's better than Norman Osborn, right? She might not be better than Tim Drake, but I'm biased.
Yeah, I think that might be the for Tim Drake.
Well, I Rogue pays the bills, son.
I don't think she goes above Black Canary.
Okay.
I could put her above Mary Jane.
Then I think we should put her there. I think Rogue goes at number 24 on the list.
Next up on the list is somebody I just brought up, Storm.
Storm's rad.
Storm is also great.
Also fun to write.
Because I talked about Storm being regal and poised, but what's great about Storm is that she has those moments where she says, fuck it.
Storm being like a thief and a pickpocket, and then grow like when she's a teenager, suddenly being worshipped as a goddess, and then going, oh, this is right. This is correct. Yeah, I used to be a child. You know, obviously. What did you do when you were a kid? You pickpocketed and stole things, right? Well, yeah, then you grow up and you become a goddess, of course. I love her. She's great. It's very difficult to write a character who expects to be treated like a goddess at all times, who isn't a jerk about it. You know, she's not Maxima. She's not, she's not even, you know, jerk Aquaman. She's like, oh yeah, like, I'm part of this team, we're all friends, but, you know, I do control the weather. that's Zeus shit.
It really gives her an interesting dynamic, especially when she goes through those I'm gonna rebel periods, which she occasionally has, where she has a mohawk.
Yes.
I love that dichotomy of Storm, where, like, literally she has a Storm-like volatility.
Yes. Yeah, I think you said it. She's kind of, like, volatile, but she's always – she has a confidence. Like, even when she's rebelling, like, she's not pushing back against what she used to be. She's pushing back against what you want her to be.
That is absolutely right. It's never that she loses herself. It's that – she's going to swerve you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
let's figure out where she goes. I mean, again, it's kind of in this. It's kind of in this same neighborhood, I think.
Again, biased. Storm pays the bills, or paid the bills. this month is the final bill being paid by Storm for me. I like Storm more than I like Wonder Woman. I don't know if I like her as much as I like Big Barda, but like I could see her going around like the Ray Smuckles to Big Barda section of the list.
I'm gonna argue her down from going above Wonder Woman, but I could put her above Wolverine.
Then I think we should do that. I think that's where she goes.
Okay, that's where Storm goes.
Aurora Monroe.
Up next,
maybe the worst civilian name.
Worst best.
Worst best.
Up next on Josh's list is Catwoman, Selina Kyle.
Shit. Catwoman rules.
Yep.
Oh, Catwoman's real good, Matt.
I could argue that the flaw of Catwoman is that she has no set alignment, that her alignment of good or bad is always fluid, and that Batman works with her despite her criminal acts. But that's a Batman problem. That's not a Catwoman problem.
The problem with Catwoman is that she is the archetype of a female character who's a villain who becomes a good guy, becomes a hero purely through romantic interest in a hero, you know? Like, there is a very frustrating trope in all media of women who are evil until they meet the heroic man and are then seduced into a life of goodness. And to be fair, Catwoman never quite gets there. Like, even as a protagonist, and she's great as a protagonist, she's still following her own agenda. And she's still frequently in conflict with Batman. But I feel like that is a thing that both holds her back, because that's, again, it's a frustrating trope. But she is also arguably the single best example of it, like, in terms of being a good character who also fits that trope.
Anytime I think writers or editors or whoever is making the decisions decides to put her in a box where they're like, okay, she's a superhero now. Like, we're going to give her own book and she's a superhero now. Or she's gone totally villain again. They're missing the point of Catwoman.
Yeah.
Because Catwoman is, by her nature, to use wrestling parlance, a tweener.
She's, in the way that Storm is volatile like a storm, Catwoman is cat-like. She can, you know, cats will come up and they'll rub on your leg and then they'll bring you dead mice. And then sometimes they will just scratch the shit out of you for no reason. That's why I don't like cats.
They'll rub your leg and then a second later swipe at you. I mean, some cats, not all cats, but yeah. I mean, it's that kind of thing. It's like, but they have their reasons, and Catwoman has her reasons. And I think, especially in the recent past, a lot of writers have figured it out. They've figured out that Selina Kyle is, at her heart, a good person with good intentions who simply has a different moral center than most people. She is willing to do things that most people will not do to achieve those good intentions.
Yeah. You don't have to change her to make her a protagonist. You like, again, in wrestling parlance, her alignment is often defined by who her opponent is. Like, is she going after Batman? Well, then she's a bad guy, because Batman's gonna be right. But is she protecting the East End? And is she, you know, planning an elaborate heist against Lex Luthor? We saw in the New Talent Showcase, Catwoman being hired by Wonder Woman to steal God stuff is brilliant. Because that's the kind of thing Catwoman could do.
Or like, you know, if she's going up against Black Mask, right? Or she might be going against Batman, or she might be teaming up with Batman. And that's all part of Catwoman. Those things are not at odds. It just, if Batman is doing what is also her agenda, she'll work with him. If he's working counter to her agenda, she'll work against him. That's what's occasionally frustrating about Catwoman, but ultimately great about Catwoman. Does Catwoman get into the top 15?
Well, at number 15, we have Batwoman. I think if Catwoman gets on this list, she, like, into the top 15, she goes just above Batwoman.
I think
Does she go above Lex? I think she goes above Lex. She's been good longer than Lex. But she hasn't been as good as Lex, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think you nailed it. I think it's between Lex and Batwoman.
So, Selina Kyle, Catwoman, goes into the list at number 15.
Up next on Josh's list is Ted Grant, Wildcat.
Fuck, I love Ted Grant. You know what's great about Ted Grant? Ted Grant has no superpowers. He's just a dude who likes to punch people and dressed up like a kitty cat. That's all you have to do.
He is a punching guy. He's a punching guy and a kitty cat.
Oh, top Batman had a box. Brilliant. Brilliant.
I was just going to say one of the best episodes of Justice League Unlimited is about Wildcat, but we can't count that.
Wildcat might actually be my favorite member of the JSA. Black Canary, not accepted. Black Canary accepted, I mean. We have Alan Scott on the list, don't we? No, we don't. We didn't get him at the Green Lanterns.
We do not have Alan Scott on the list.
I mean, God, I do like him. Now we're getting to, like, we've been focusing on the same part of the list all night, and now I'm looking at, like, where I want to put Wildcat, and it's like, yeah, Wildcat, should he go between Michelangelo, the Ninja Turtle, and Rorschach from Watchmen?
I mean, that's kind of where I'm looking, too. I mean, I think that's a good spot for him.
Yeah. Number 56, no discussion necessary. Wildcat 1.
Okay.
Ted Grant.
Finally on Josh's list is Don Diego Vega, Zorro.
Did you go through a Zorro phase, Matt?
I watched the USA Zorro TV series, whichever one that was.
Back in the early-ish 90s?
It was an early 90s TV series about Zorro. I think it was just called Zorro.
His name is Zorro. Talk about that one.
That's the one. Yeah. It started in 1990. So there you go.
I like Zorro. Zorro's good. He ain't Batman.
Zorro's good. Apparently it was not on USA. It was on the Family Channel.
Yeah, dog. Family Channel. Zorro was very... That show was... Okay. I would love to watch that show again because I remember it being very Batman 66. If Batman 66 was made in the 90s. He had a fucking Batcave.
The thing is, there are so many versions of Zorro in all kinds of media. He doesn't originate in comics. We'd have to rank only comics Zorro.
Well, if we're only ranking comic Zorro, I mean, that's not a bad way, because we've got that Matt Wagner series is pretty good. Like, and also there's a bunch of Alex
series is not
Zorro's
bad.
And that Zorro Django Unchained crossover that came out that was really good.
I don't know. I mean, Zorro's fine. Zorro is fine.
We would not have Batman without him, but Batman makes him unnecessary.
Zorro was a pulp character, right? When you bring him into comics, it ends up being what happens with a lot of pulp characters, where they're informed by the characters who were influenced by them instead of vice versa. Do you have a place in mind, an area?
I mean, I like Zorro more than I like Barry Allen. I don't like him as much as I like Carrie Kelly. He's not as good as Shane Sexcastle.
No.
Probably.
I put Simon Boz ahead of him.
I think he's better than Miss Misery.
Okay, then let's put him there between
Number
Simon
66.
Boz and Miss Misery.
Don Diego de la Vega.
All right, let's try to get through this list as quick as we can. This is from Seth Finkelstein. And the list is Small Heroes.
Okay.
The first one on Seth's list is Scott Lang, Ant-Man.
I have very few feelings about Scott Lang.
Yeah, Scott Lang is kind of just there.
I like the movie a lot.
Yeah. It's just like he's a replacement for Hank Pym. And in some ways I think he's a reaction to Hank Pym. Because all there is about Scott Lang really is good guy. Scott Lang is a good guy. And that's about all you got.
We have Hank Pym on the list at number 88.
Yeah. I don't think he doesn't go above Hank Pym.
Okay. What do you think he goes going down? Hank Pym's number 88. We still got some good characters at this section of the list. Bad Rock's in there, 10 spots lower. Love some Bad Rock.
I put him above, like, Coach Boss.
Okay. What a weird list. See, now the list is getting weird.
Yeah, now it's getting weird.
I would definitely put him above Vulcan, but I don't know if I'd put him above Ultramagnus.
Okay, then that's a spot between Ultramagnus and Vulcan. Next up, somebody who is considerably better than Scott Lang, his daughter, Cassie Lang.
Talking about stature?
Stinger.
Oh, she's Stinger now?
She is Stinger now, but she was stature, yes.
She was stature for a little bit.
When she was in the Young Avengers, she was stature.
I know nothing about Cassie being Stinger. Like, I am completely unfamiliar with her in that role.
Yeah, I mean, most of the stories I know her from, she is stature. I do like Cassie. I mean,
wait a second. Wait just a second. Is Stinger an MC2 thing?
Oh, well, it was an MC2 thing.
I knew it. I can sense a Spider-Girl universe character from a mile off.
But she is Stinger now also.
Okay.
She became Stinger in Astonishing Ant-Man.
Okay. I do not have a lot of special feelings for Cassie Lang. I like her. She's fine.
I like her more than her dad.
Teenage girl is inherently more interesting in the world of superheroes than solid dude.
Yeah, I guess she has some of the same blandness as her dad, but she also drove some of the stories in Young Avengers.
Honestly, I think she might be the least interesting of the Young Avengers to me, of that era's Young Avengers.
All those characters are very interesting, like Hulkling, Wiccan, all those characters are pretty interesting in a way that maybe Cassie is not quite. I can buy that.
I'm sorry, I'm reading up on Cassie Lang, and I just found out she's a member of a team called the Global Reaction Agency for Mysterious Paranormal Activity, or GRAMPA. Which was apparently created by Greg Pak and Takeshi Miyazawa in Amazing Fantasy number 15. I think that might have been a Dan Slott creation, though. Anyway, where are we putting Cassie Lang? You like her better than Scott?
I like her better than Scott.
I still don't think I like her more than Ultramagnus.
I would maybe have argued her up a little bit, but
where do you want to put her?
I don't think I'd put her above Starfire. So. And I don't know enough about Ultramagnus to argue, so I guess she's going right above her dad.
No, look, I will put her in deference to you, but when you read those Transformers comics, we're coming back to this.
No, just do it. I don't know enough about Ultramagnus to make that decision. So if you think she goes,
Matt, where do you find out about Minimus Animus? Because where do you find out about?
Okay, all right. Next up on Seth's list is Eric O'Grady, the irredeemable Ant-Man / Black Ant.
Okay, real talk. I liked Eric O'Grady as a character. Like, as a character, it is very, like, the one thing about Eric O'Grady is he very quickly gets to the point where you're like, oh wait, fuck this dude. This guy's a piece of shit.
But that's how you're supposed to feel about him.
Yeah, but you do, like, he's still the protagonist of the book, and you're supposed to kind of still want to see him win, but he's, like, such a fucking scumbag. Like, it lives up to the name of the book. I think Eric O'Grady, yeah. Like, I think he's fun because of that, but I think he's, like, what you just want to see him get the shit kicked out of him.
In much the same way that I feel like Scott Lang is a reaction to Hank Pym,
mm-hmm.
Eric O'Grady is a reaction in the other direction. Where it's like, okay, we had an Ant-Man who was just a good guy. Now let's have an Ant-Man who's a piece of shit.
I still think that book's good. Phil Hester's art in that book is fantastic.
But that book is really good.
I
enjoyed jerk. It greatly.
Like, what
yeah,
a what
he a is a total jerk.
A-hole.
But I guess the question is, like, does that make him a worse character if he achieves his stated goal of making you feel like he sucks.
I think this is a much less controversial and much less involved conversation that is still very similar to the one we had about Rorschach. Rorschach's like a reprehensible person, but a very good character. Eric O'Grady, I think, is a not as good, obviously, not as interesting, but like still pretty fun to read about. If only does eventually get the shit kicked out of him.
Look, I still don't think he goes above Hank Pym. But would he go above, like, Clarion the Witch Boy?
No, Clarion the Witch Boy is a much better jerk.
What about...
He wouldn't go above,
like,
Teekle.
Well, okay, I don't think he goes above Parker.
No, here's where he goes. He goes right below Todd the Squirrel. That's where he goes.
He goes right below Todd T. Squirrel. You're absolutely right about that. Okay, that's Eric O'Grady. Next up on Seth's list is Ray Palmer, the Atom.
Love that dude. Of all the kind of bland, weird scientist heroes of the 60s, Ray Palmer might be the best. He's at least on par with Barry Allen, I think.
He's bland, but in an interesting way.
Well, here's what would have made Barry Allen better. If Barry Allen spent 5 years as a fucking barbarian king.
That story is great.
Yeah. I thought they were going to do that on Legends of Tomorrow, but they didn't.
They half did it.
They sent him back to dinosaur time for like an hour. And then everybody was like, "Oh, Ray Palmer, you're a piece of shit. We all hate you, you loser." And I was like, why?
Is he better? So he's better than Barry Allen, above Barry Allen?
Well, we have Ryan Choi on the list already, don't we?
Yes, we do.
I don't think he's as good as Ryan Choi, but I think he's close.
Okay, right below Ryan is Kerry Kelly, Shane Sexcastle, Simon Boz, Miss Misery, Hobbs. We added somebody in there, too.
I think right now he goes above Simon Boz, under Shane Sexcastle.
Okay. I am fine with that being where Ray Palmer lives.
Honestly, being a physics professor who becomes a superhero, who becomes a tiny little Conan, is a very Shane Sexcastle thing to do.
Fair. 100% fair. Rounding out Seth's list is Yellowjacket 2, Rita DeMara.
I know nothing about her. She was in the Busick Perez one, right? I know nothing about her.
She was in the Roger Stern run.
Oh, I know even less.
If she had been in the Busick Perez run, I would know everything about her.
I mean, I've read that run. There is a Yellowjacket in that run, right?
It's Hank Pym.
Oh, that's right. He's Yellowjacket then. I forgot. Yeah.
This version of Yellowjacket, I am totally unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
She's around in the late 80s. And then she joins the Guardians of the Galaxy and dies.
Yeah, the Guardians of the Galaxy who are in the 31st century.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. No,
Yeah, she traveled forward to the 31st century.
I know zero things about her.
Yeah, me too. So we're going to have to disqualify her. But based on costume, she is of her time. Thank you, Seth, for that list. I think we did a good job of trying to bring a little more gender equality to this list. Hopefully we will do more of that soon. If you would like to send us a panel president list, you can do so by emailing us at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also where you can send every story ever lists, listener questions, if you have them. If you would just like to send us a comment, you know, what you're thinking about the show, anything like that, you can email it to us. Or if you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know there. You can also send listener questions to our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. Be sure to check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can read show notes, download the show, stream the show, and leave comments. Leave us a review on iTunes if you like the show. The more positive reviews we get there, the more we are featured. Now we're going to tell you where you can find all our stuff online. For me, all you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net, and you'll find links to all my stuff. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
Everybody can find links to my stuff at the-isb.com. That has links to everything that I write, my comics that are currently available in Comixology, and also podcasts that I do in addition to this one. Matt and I obviously do Movie Fighters together, and we had a real fun episode for November watching the 4th Equestria Girls movie So definitely listen to that. I think it's one of the best we've done in a while. Maybe since Surviving Christmas, or Saving Christmas is what it was.
We had to survive that movie.
God. We got another Christmas coming up, so if anybody's got suggestions, hit us up. Also, Allison Stock and I just launched a new podcast. It's a spinoff of Sailor Business. It's called Xena Warrior Business. We're watching every episode of Xena Warrior Princess and talking about it. The Zero episode is up now, which is us talking about her first 3-episode arc on Hercules Legendary Journeys, where she was introduced. But then this week, as you're listening to us, maybe even today, episode 1, where we talk about the first episode of Xena, is going to be going up. So if you like hearing me talk about TV stuff, then definitely check that out, and thank you for doing so. That does it for War Rocket Ajax, episode 332. Matt, S-Rank, once again?
Yeah, before we wrap up, we decided we were going to give some ideas for people to donate to here at the end of the show.
Yes.
So I'm going to go ahead and put out there that people can donate to the SPLC.
That was going to be mine too. We didn't actually talk about this before the show, but that was also going to be mine.
The Southern Poverty Law Center is an organization that's doing a lot for tolerance and equality to help educate people about, you know, racial equality and generally fighting hate in the world, which I think is something that we can all agree on. SPLC, a great history as a civil rights organization, and they're going to be working for a lot of people over the next several years, I think. So SPLCenter.org is their website. If you want to go donate to them, I think it would be a great place.
I actually, last Friday, the Friday after Thanksgiving, I was walking around downtown Durham, and the SPLC had people literally on the street just talking to people about fighting against hatred and bigotry, and handing out little pamphlets that gave you tips on how to speak up. Like, if you hear something, like little scripts you can follow to ask people why they're saying that, like if they know what they're doing, and how to support other people who are speaking up. And I thought that was a very valuable thing to have out there. They do a lot of good work. So SPLCenter.org, definitely, if you're looking for a place to donate, that's a really good one. But that does it for this week's episode of Ajax. We'll be back next week with another one. And then the week after that is the Ajax Christmas special. So 2016 is rapidly coming to a close and cannot happen soon enough. Have a great week, everybody.
Yeah! Flash.